ready whenever you are.
Hey everyone, and welcome to today's Ladies' Room. I'm Aisling and I'm here with the great Dr. Teresa. How are you today?
I'm pretty great. That sounds like a very overinflated introduction, but I'm feeling pretty great.
All right, well,
I'm feeling
good.
Pretty great and happy to be here. How about you?
I'm doing great, thank you. I'm happy to be here also and happy to be talking to you, as always. Today we're going to talk about food preoccupation, and a lot of ladies struggle with this food preoccupation. And what that means is constantly thinking about food. You know, even when you're eating food, you just had food, it's always this constant thought on your mind, where is my next meal going to come from? What am I going to have? What's in that food? You know, it's always just thinking about food. Can you kind of give us maybe a little bit of an insight as to why people have so much food preoccupation? Is it from the dieting or?
Well, we definitely are preoccupied, meaning we can't be occupied with other things because there's this thought of food or eating or when we're going to next eat on our brain. And it would make sense that people would be very food preoccupied if they were starving. So we know, like, when they've done the Minnesota experiment and things like that, or people actually were in famines, that it changes everything about their behavior and they become very food preoccupied and lose interest in all other things. And in fact, they never lose that once they are able to have access to food again. But we don't live in that world. We live in a world full of food. So we are having preoccupation in the exact opposite of circumstances. I mean, mm-hmm. we basically are, you know, why do we need to think about it and the exposure to it? What is it that makes it like we're at, you know, Willy Wonka land at the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory? Why are we one of the kids that are totally preoccupied and not like Willy Wonka, who doesn't seem preoccupied at all? And why do we can watch shows on TV like Top Chef and things like that, and you see people who are surrounded with food and they're tasting food and restaurant critics, and mm-hmm. they're usually not heavy.
Right.
Why?
Yeah.
Why? What? Do they have so much more control than we do?
Right.
And we don't know exactly the answers to these, and they might be different from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things about food that have really changed, and there are good reasons why we'd be food preoccupied. To start with is a default position for a human being is to be food preoccupied.
Okay.
So from the moment that we're born, we need to have cues that are coming from our food. Everybody knows about drugs, right? That when you say drugs, we have a picture in mind of drugs are either sort of illegal drugs, which are euphoric drugs, which are
right.
drugs of abuse. So sometimes people put alcohol as my drug of choice, they will say, but it's a mind-altering substance. So we think of drugs as like narcotics, like heroin or Vicodin, you know, those sort of things. We know cocaine, crack cocaine, that's a drug.
Right.
We know that marijuana or weed, you know, we know that's a drug. We know that these things, and then I said some people consider alcohol to be a drug, and then a variety of other pills and substances
right.
like meth and that, you know, those are all uppers. And then there's just single mind altering drugs like ecstasy or LSD or hallucinogenics or things. So everybody knows when you go, that's a drug. Then they also know that there's drugs, prescription drugs that a doctor could write for you to take to treat things that are wrong with
mm-hmm.
you. But of course, many of the drugs that we're taking for what's wrong with us today are mood altering.
Right.
Because one of the most common set of drugs are these drugs that help us deal with anxiety, depression, you know, mood substances.
Yeah.
So they're still drugs as well. So what we need to do is go back in order to understand food preoccupation is that it's there for a reason. Our body is trying to help us. And that when we talk about drugs, it's not this external thing. For us to feel the effects of a drug, there has to be a receptor for that drug in our body, which generally means that we can make something ourselves that has those effects.
So, as in, we can make a drug in our body that mimics the drugs
yes,
outside?
Yes, we have like, we have...
Our in-house laboratory?
Right, we have our in-house laboratory. We have our own personal pharmacy. And the most common one that people sort of know about is that they know that there's endorphins. Okay. So a lot of times people have heard of endorphins and they think of them in terms of runner's high. Right. And I know because I treat a lot of runners that come with a variety of complaints or problems or things like that. And I'm always like trying to get to the bottom of why do you run? Because running might not be the right sport for them because they're thinking they're going to get something and they've actually just chosen wrong.
Okay.
So they make an assumption like running's good for me, more running is better for me.
Right.
Running will make me thin because I look at people who run and they're thin and they must be thin mm-hmm. because they run. So all of those things are misconceptions. But the other thing they know about is the runner's high.
Yes.
Okay, so they go, well, I run because I get this runner's high. And I'm like, okay, this is a problem. And if you run because you feel like I need this time to myself and it feels like stress reduction and I come back and I feel rejuvenated and running really makes me feel good, or I run with someone and it's my social time, or
right.
I like to be out with my dog and I run, you know, these are really good reasons to run. But running for to think that you'll lose weight, especially if you don't like it, if you dread it, this is really a problem because it doesn't get to the other end of where this problem is.
Mm-hmm.
So the runner's high, so it's just my way, as you know from having done these podcasts with me, is I kind of say surprising things that people are completely unprepared for.
Right.
And one of the ones with the runner's high is the way endorphins work is they're your body's natural painkillers.
Right.
So you don't get your shot of painkiller until you're in pain. So
okay.
a lot of people are running to get that runner's high, which is they will put themselves through pain to get their payoff.
Right, okay.
So you don't have little kids wake up going, oh, I'm going to go run around to get my runner's high.
Yes.
You don't get that until your body basically says, you're going to die. The only reason to run like this would be to run from something.
Right, like a tiger.
Like a tiger.
Yeah.
Which would be actually a good run because that would be a dash.
Yes.
And then you would get this runner's high as like it could either take away the pain so that you could run through pain, or it would take away the pain of your, you know, give you that last hurrah,
mm-hmm.
you know, nirvana before you, you know, kick the bucket. But the reality is that we do have an ability to run, and some people are built very well for that. And so you can look that one of the ways that humans hunt is that we're actually able to run slower. It is sort of a jog, slower and longer than other animals because they have to stop because they're overheating.
Okay.
So they can dash and stop, and we can kind of keep going, and we can surround them and hunt them down. We're sort of the velociraptors of the modern world.
Like, right.
You know, we put those all in the Jurassic Park, like the cooperate,
gotcha.
You know, but that's a lot invented. But that is really how humans, they surround, they capture, they, you know, run things off of cliffs. But most of these animals that we would chase down, they can't keep running. And we also have a really great ability to get rid of heat so we can run during a hot time.
Okay.
But not every culture on Earth is set up to do this. So this was a really good way of hunting animals that would run from you, like in the savannah. So
mm-hmm.
some people are built for enjoying this and this longer, slower running, and it's stress relieving to them, and they could run very efficiently. Their body's put together the right way. But some people are not. They're built to hold on to calories.
Right.
Okay, so they are, there are people who are naturally lean,
mm-hmm.
and there's people who are naturally not lean. So I always liked the basis of this food preoccupation is you can make people food preoccupied no matter what. So I like to use the example of the sumo wrestlers. I know I've told you this before.
Right, yes.
Which is very, the whole training for gaining thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, what do you mean training for gaining? Well, sumo wrestling has had a very huge place of importance in Japanese history for many, many centuries. In fact, they have like the legend of how Japan was given to the Japanese people was that it was won in a sumo wrestling contest.
Mm-hmm.
So there were places where you would go, you would be picked and you would go and live there and subjected to an environment that would basically help a naturally lean person become very, very fat.
Right.
So Japanese are naturally much leaner. They have a high, their island means that there's lots of micronutrient availability, so they have a high quantity of building blocks to fuel, so they don't need a lot of rice. And they, you know, people use Okinawa, like they would use them as an example. They say, oh, they eat this very lean diet and rice and things, but it actually means like pork loving or something like that. And
right.
So they eat pig, you know, from the snort to the tail. I can't remember. It's like there's like this Japanese saying is like all the pig is, every bit of the pig is full of deliciousness.
Okay.
From the tip of their nose to the tip of their tail. So that was a important part of that. And then when you look at sumo, is you look at these people and think, oh, they must have hunted all around to find these very fat men to become sumo wrestlers.
Right.
But in fact, they would never ever recruit heavy young men because they feel like they are not committed to the training, that they would be lazy. So they look for very lean, athletic young men, and then they would put them on a training for gaining regimen that would take many years, which mainly involved years. 10 years.
Wow.
Because it's not that easy.
And it's natural for them to be lean. So
yes, it's natural for them to be
changing their whole
environment. So the hilarious thing is it bears a great deal of, it's a lot like being an American at a gym. So they would put them on a low fat diet, very low fat, less than 10% fat. So lots of noodles. There was like a fish stew that they have a special name for it. So it's a, you know, it had the fish or the omega-3. So they were getting their micronutrients in this broth. But they'd work out very hard and very long. So they would get an insatiable appetite. And then they would have to watch other people eating. So the skinnier ones have to watch the fatter ones eat first so that they would work their hunger up and feel like deprived because they would be very hungry, but they wouldn't be allowed to eat first. And they ate this very low fat in huge serving containers. You know, we've talked about the 9-inch plate. Mm-hmm. So they were like enormous tureens of dishes, like, and they just slurped this down and they drank a lot of beer. So you could have as much beer as you want. And then that was, and you have people yell at you and stress you out.
Oh, okay.
And then it takes 10 years for them to
accumulate
to triple their body weight, basically, which is what they want to do. Or, 5 to 10 years. It's very hard to start as a teenager and to put on that amount of weight. So, yes, there's a lot of muscle. They're full of muscle and they have a lot of fat, too.
Right.
So what they found is that if you take Samoans or Polynesians or Mongolians from these different climates, so Polynesians, obviously, that's sort of a beachy Hawaii, you know, and Samoans, but also Mongolians, then that's totally freezing.
Right.
That their history was one of more deprivation. So they naturally get fat, and they hold on to the extra weight. You know, Eskimos are like, you know, they are stocky.
Right.
So when you subject them to the sumo school, they get fat so much faster than native Japanese do. And of course, these are generalizations.
Right.
But they are kind of point out to the fact that, you know, especially with island people, is the genetics tend to be more similar. We're becoming more global and there's a lot more mix.
Mm-hmm.
So I always say that a big problem in America is that what makes you American? Well, America is a land of all these immigrants that have come from other places. So what makes you an American is you come from people that left somewhere else for opportunity. So they are inherently different. So Native Americans were already here, so they didn't leave.
Right.
African Americans you usually came from being a slave at some point. So they didn't come here as a land of opportunity. They were shifted here.
Right.
And they've had generally more of these difficulties, but what it meant to be an immigrant was to actually be different than the people who are left behind.
Okay.
So one of the things that we do is people say, you Americans just don't know how to relax. You're like always on, you're always fretting about everything. You're so intense. You're intense about your relaxation even. Like, you can't just relax. You have to go on a vacation.
Right.
And then you have to be so, like, tense on your vacation that you need a vacation from your vacation.
Yeah.
And it's really in these differences of why we would have come here. And I say that what makes you an American means that you were able to live in the land of endless summer.
Right.
So in our hormones, the food preoccupation, the drugs that we're going to get back for, this internal pharmacy, mm-hmm. is that you're making and signaling. And in the course of the natural world, you have winter, which means food is scarce.
Right.
So what do we do to build up our fat stores before winter comes along so that we have enough body fat to last us until there's food available? Because mm-hmm. you know, obviously you can eat animals, there's no vegetation growing, but they might not be that available. You know,
right.
they're like, the animals don't have anything to eat either. So everything kind of goes down, all
right.
the supply goes down. And we have a hard time conceptualizing this because we have grocery stores now. So we don't think that there was a time where there'd just be nothing to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Or we don't think about a time like America, which is a land of agriculture and planting and amber waves of grain, was a place where Native Americans lived, and they didn't eat very much plant substances at all.
Right.
Because plant substances for humans for most of our existence was like the tubers, the roots that are under the ground.
Okay.
Because we can't eat vegetation.
Right.
So fields of grain are fields of grass.
Right.
So until we change the grass so that it was actually worth harvesting and processing and doing all that, it just wasn't worth it. So since we're animals, you can, you know, animals are more nutrient dense and they're made of animal stuff. So eating nose to tail from an animal is usually pretty good to go. So we know that some populations over the course of the, you know, humans can sort of live everywhere. They can adapt, but it's easy to adapt to an animal-based diet because the building blocks are animal-based. We don't have to convert them, and we don't need a lot of special bacteria, and we don't need to get rid of so many antitoxins.
Do you think that the food preoccupation comes from not eating these building blocks anymore, or?
I do. I really do think that, but it doesn't matter whether it's a plant or an animal source, is that everything is made of building blocks in the circle of life. So everything is broken down and built back up. So if you start to deplete the soil, then the plants are not going to be as nourishing. If you start to deplete the plants, then the animals that eat them are also going to be less nourished.
Okay.
If you take an animal that would have a very varied diet and start giving them one thing to eat, they are going to be made of those building blocks. They're going to be lacking building blocks themselves.
Right.
So, you know, a really good example of that would be one of my favorite micronutrient foods that you can see the difference is an egg.
Okay.
Okay, so an egg is, think of it, it has, you know, I always say the mammals broke the shell, but any animal that's an egg, it's different than plants can make their own food, animals, and they make a seed to last them, but an animal has to, when they lay an egg, everything, all the ingredients to make a new animal from scratch have to be inside that egg.
Okay.
So all the building blocks are inside the yolk, not the white. The white is kind of like where the waste goes.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's water soluble because it's closed, so the waste has to still get out.
So, you know, that the these people who get really crazy into like no fat in their diet and they do all egg white omelets.
Yes.
Are they not getting any of the building blocks in there, or
there's very few building. It's protein.
Right.
It's like pure protein, but you have to be protein deficient to need that. And we can't store protein.
Right.
So
for you to need
to use extra protein over the course of a day, you have to be growing or you have to be breaking down and needing to build up. So, you know, men that are like looking to bulk up, they understand that you have to tear down and eat more protein and then you can build bigger muscles. I call their muscles, they're like leaky balloons, like a pinhole in them.
Okay.
As long as you're not working them out, they start, you know, basically to get back down to where the set point is. And some men have very long, slender, still very strong muscles, like a chimpanzee, which is a very strong animal.
Right.
Or they might be like gorilla muscles, like big, bulky. And naturally that's their set point. So they would be built up without necessarily doing that. We all know this. at some level we know it. You sit there and you watch these like rock and rollers and things like that, knowing that they eat crap, drink all the time.
Right.
And they're prancing around these young men with these buff, gorgeous bodies. And you know that they are not working out.
Right.
And they just have beautiful, gorgeous muscles. And you go, what? You know, it doesn't last forever, but they have that natural ability to do that. Testosterone helps a lot with that. For females to do that, that requires a lot more work.
I know. It's so unfair.
It's so unfair, but it's built into why we have these food preoccupations to start with, as I said, is that we have these seasons. So if you need to get up, I mean, humans have this big brain, so we needed things built into our brain to have it paid off, because our brain's 2% of our body weight, but it uses 25% of the available energy. So it's using oxygen and fuel all the time, 24 hours a day, even when you're sleeping. And most people think you're only burning calories when you exercise, and that's a very, very small percentage of the calories that we burn over the course of the day. So most of them are burned through non-exercise activated thermogenesis, like the fidgeting or just moving around, and then the vast majority is just running our organs, and our brain is the one that requires the most fuel.
Right.
So all, for us to have gotten this big brain, we have to have a drive to want to eat food. So I think that humans, you know, and dogs who we invented have this crazy food drive, like insatiable.
Right.
So it's easy to tweak us to, you know, kick that into effect, because you have to wake up in the morning and go out and forage. You have to go look for food to do this and basically figure out ways how not to expend any extra effort to do it. So we are a victim of our physiology, and sometimes I think we're gonna end up being extinct like a cheetah. You know, cheetahs are sort of too fast for their own good.
Right.
And because they exhaust themselves, they have really small jaw, so they can run really, really fast, and then they go into heart failure, and they have no crush in their jaw, so what they catch, they have to lay there and hope something else doesn't take it from them before they're gone.
Right.
So they did well in a world where there was really fast antelopes, but they're not necessarily there. And in fact, it's really interesting. I worked in a zoo, so I love all this animal trivia. Is there's an antelope in America called a pronghorn, and it runs way faster than anything else, so nothing would catch it. But at one point, we had what was called a lot of megafauna. Megaflora means big plants, megafauna means big animals.
Right.
And humans, wherever humans went, we hunted down all the megafauna. And there was very big cheetahs that could run fast as those pronghorns. They're not there, but the antelopes are still left running faster than anything else. Well, we are smarter. We might end up being too smart for our own good.
Right.
We might be the victim of our own extinction, because we can't not make technology, tool making, ways of making our lives easier, ways of making food more delicious, more accessible, more ability to have every day a feast instead of dealing with every day a famine. Because starvation was a reality in the world we lived in for millions of years, not hundreds of years, not thousands of years, millions
of
years.
Well, that's, you know, such a big part of the problem, that we have made food so accessible, we have made it so delicious, and we have put so many chemicals into it that make us want to have it all the time. Food is a drug these days, so there's, you know, no wonder that we're always preoccupied.
And so what enhances the preoccupation is lots of these cues. So for example, one of the things that would enhance food preoccupation is these cues that winter is coming. You know, Game of Thrones, winter is coming, winter is coming, winter is coming, and it might last a long time. And this was felt in your body and taught to you by anyone that was around you, is that winter would be there and the food wouldn't be available, and you have to eat food while it is available. So it's true, people could tell you that, but our body is very cued into things like light.
Yes.
So when the days are long and there's sugar available, eat, 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 store fat, because long days, available sugar means winter is coming, winter is coming, winter is coming. But we in America live in endless summer where we're able to tolerate. You know, we don't die as fast. We get chronic diseases. So we were able to tolerate this high-stress lifestyle, because what did that mean for us ancestrally was that was the time that you went and you made babies and you got ready for the next generation.
Right.
You got ready. So we work harder.
Mm-hmm.
We can't relax as well. We want this productivity that's fueled by lights and sugar, which is basically, we live in a 7-Eleven, which is, they don't even have those anymore. It was a store that was invented when, you know, stores would be open only during normal daytime hours.
Right.
And then they invented this kind of store called a 7-Eleven, which means basically it was open before and closed later. Now you go everywhere. I know from, you come from Ireland and you're really surprised. It was like, oh my God, you can get food all over the place, anywhere. Every
yeah.
gas station's open 24/7. And what do? You walk in, there's bright lights that never go off.
Right.
We live in all this light in front of our plasma screen TVs. We're like, summer, summer, summer. So a lot of our food drive even starts. That's a cue.
Right.
We're terribly cued by food availability. There it is. When it's there, you have to eat it. What we dealt before when there was time where there was a lot of abundance and people adjusted to it, royalty had abundance.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else, all the peasants were starving and all the royalty had all this food. They didn't have fancy stuff. They didn't have iPhones.
Yeah.
They didn't have television.
Mm-hmm.
They had food. You know,
yeah.
that was like your entertainment and your luxury. So there was food, and if you were wealthy, you could have food all of the time. So why were people not fat? Why do we think of Henry VIII, and the first thing that comes in our mind is a picture of a big fat guy?
Right.
Well, if everybody was as fat as he was in his court, we wouldn't think of him that way, because that's how everybody would have looked.
Yeah.
So what did all the other people who had access to food? Or, you know, I was on my Downton Abbey marathon, and I look and it's like, oh my God, they eat these elaborate dinners, but they're so skinny.
Right.
And they really were skinny at that time, because when we had abundant food, we made all these sort of ritual mm-hmm. to control our eating. You
okay.
know, that food had to be prepared. There were certain times. Food wasn't instantly available.
Well,
that's what the difference is now, is it's right there.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, a lot of work went into getting the food too. And you know, it wasn't just like you could go to the shop and buy whatever fruit you wanted. It was seasonal.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that's a big factor too. I mean, you can't, like right. now, everybody has a car. You don't even have to walk to the shops anymore. Nobody walks to the shops anymore. You want something, you get into your nice warm car, you drive down to the shop, you go in, you buy your stuff, you get back into your car, back into your nice warm house. It's not a big effort to go and buy yourself a lot of bad food.
Right, and really the one of the biggest triggers is the sugar.
Right.
So we live in a world of sugar,
mm-hmm.
where sugar before would have only come from fruit.
Oh, can we just say as well, drive-thrus are like, you don't even have to get out of your car. How
no.
insane.
No.
Like, you want something, you want a meal, get into your car, speak to somebody through a window, and then go to the next window, here's your bag of food, and then drive home
right,
again.
Right, and you can, like, shove it in your mouth. Like,
you
they
can,
have, like,
yes.
breakfast cereal in cups already, like, where you can drink your breakfast cereal.
Right.
Go-gurt, which is like yogurt in a tube, so you can literally squeeze it in your mouth like something from a science fiction movie.
Yeah.
It's like, I have to fuel up. Like,
yeah.
no, you don't have to fuel up. You have way, way, way too much fuel already.
Yeah.
So we are overfueling, but our brain is going, fuel up, fuel up, fuel up. So the brain is queuing. This is food preoccupation. So why is our brain queuing, queuing, queuing when we obviously do not need any more food? And it's because in advertising and the food industry and the way that the food has made, you know, and I think one of the best books about this ever is David Kessler's book. He was a FDA commissioner. He did a lot of helping stopping smoking. And he wrote this great book. It's got to be close to 10 years old right now, but it's still really relevant, called The End of Overeating. I maybe have some quibbles with him about how he would deal with it, but why it exists is brilliant. So especially the first half of the book. And I don't disagree. I just think it's a little bit simplistic on
right.
the far end. But it is really that the food is made, like basically you put cheese and bacon and, you know, we know like what all our tastes are and they fire on all of those cylinders and that we have lost all track of portion size and it's very hard to resist food that's in front of you. It's very hard to resist food when other people are eating it. So we keep going through all these things and we're hitting more and more cues. And the food processors and manufacturers, they're always having to make these new products that are going to sell better. And the ones that sell better hit on more cues. And then we're building on the ones that are already better.
Right.
So we are really at a disadvantage. So the only way we could possibly battle this isn't to deal with the people who are selling food, because they're going to keep selling it. And it's convenient and it's cheap and it's delicious. And that is the deadly trinity.
Right.
It's the unholy trinity. It's killing us. It's extremely hard to resist that temptation. So we have to find a way of avoiding it. And we have to understand that in our brain, this, like I said, what makes an American is that we were able to deal with this. And in fact, the Native Americans weren't able to deal with it. They struggled a lot with the availability of, you know, as we bring our American culture around the world, slowly but surely, everyone's toppling to this endless summer
right.
disease of the processed food, of the Coca-Cola, death
yes.
by Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
And Coca-Cola is delicious, and it's a beverage, so it's like, goes down easy. You know, it's the first thing you see when we infiltrate someone is they want Coke. It's the first thing that they buy and the first thing that they want. That's an American invention of that. And the food preoccupation really involves these things that are very, very similar to the drugs that I was talking about before. And the worst of those is probably the sugar because of the dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
And dopamine is the pleasure hormone. It does a lot of other things like movement and things in different parts of your brain. But I have a t-shirt that you deserve a dopamine smile. So a dopamine smile is like, it's literally this feeling, a pleasure that is so internal, like it just erupts inside mm-hmm. of you. So I say, oh, it's, you know, if you like dogs, it's like what you smile when a puppy, you know, wriggles in your arms, or when a baby smiles at you, and you literally can't help yourself
right.
from this full face smile. It's the opposite of a fake smile.
Okay.
So, and when we see someone have a dopamine smile, we feel it almost instantly ourselves. So when we see a fake smile, we kind of know that it's a fake smile. And actors and actresses, they train to be very good at faking a fake smile. So it isn't really a full smile, but it is so close that in the context, we feel their emotions. So
right.
our brain is registering through something called our mirror neurons. You know, we feel what they are showing on their face at that time. And that's what makes watching movies and stuff so great. Like, you're kind of going through all the emotions. And of course, sporting events, you feel like you're in it.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes.
You feel all this excitement, you know, like you're like one of the players,
right.
not just a spectator. So these are all really important to being human, and they have a lot to do with why we're food preoccupied. But, you know, I think it's important to understand why we're food preoccupied, because you have to cut yourself a little slack.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to have a strategy. And that strategy has to work for you personally. So I start off, you know, a lot of this, my book is called Evolutionary Eating, because we just are human at the end of
mm-hmm.
this. And I really like the idea that you shouldn't fight your physiology. That's where you're getting into trouble. It's so exhausting that you're gonna fail.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to go through and find out what works best for you, and to understand that human beings haven't evolved really. I mean, evolution means changing into a new species. So once we became humans, we obviously haven't evolved into a new kind of human that would have a different name.
Right.
Like, you know, Humanumu or something. I don't
yeah.
know. Like, but, you know, a new species. We're not a new species. We're
yeah.
still humans. So what a human is as a species is the most adaptable species on Earth. So most animals need to live in a habitat that suits their digestion and their ability to access food, and they can survive there, and they work in their, you know, ecosystem circle of life. We can go anywhere and not only survive, but thrive.
Mm-hmm.
We can eat all these varied diets, we can change food, we can prepare it, we can cook it, we can mix it together, culture, we teach each other how to do that to make the food better and
mm-hmm.
more available to us. We can store food and sell food and have some people be in charge of the food and other people do all other kinds of stuff. And this has made it really, we are so adaptable that we've forgotten that we mostly adapted all over the world to environments where food was scarce.
Okay.
Okay, that's an environment. Food was scarce. some foods are not only scarce, they're absent. Mm-hmm. Like, you're never going to eat oranges in Antarctica.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
But, and you're not even going to eat oranges in Ireland.
Yeah.
They don't grow there.
No.
Foods grow where they grow. So you wouldn't have had one. You'd have to live your whole life not getting scurvy, even though you never would get an orange.
Right.
Because there wouldn't have been an orange in Ireland.
No.
They don't grow there. But
okay.
Other things grow there that have enough vitamin C that it's not a problem. So what do we do in a land that we live now? We live in a land of abundance. And what we need to understand is we did very well as a species as long as we needed to adapt to the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Once we started trying to adapt the earth to us,
yeah,
we started doing what I call the put me in the zoo. And we now are suffering much like animals in the first zoos were, is we are becoming obese and sick and chronically ill because we're caged in this environment and we eat very concentrated, poor nutrient food that provides us with calories and fuel but is lacking in micronutrients. So I think that the first thing that people need to realize is at the basis of food preoccupation could be that you're hungry because you really are malnourished. Even if
okay.
you're really fat, you might be very malnourished. And in fact, you probably are, because if you struggle with your weight, you've been on reducing diets.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to equate low weight with health.
Okay.
That's a myth. People who never got fat are healthier than people who, that's the myth.
Okay.
Those people are different than someone who got fat and then lost weight. That does not make you the same as a person who never got fat in the first place.
Okay.
So we don't turn into that thin person by losing weight. And we often become more malnourished and more food preoccupied. And when you starve yourself, we know this from many experiments where they took normal people who had access and you deny them food and put them through starvation and they become food preoccupied, they never lose it. So dieting is voluntary starvation. So
right.
you can be assured that one of the risks of being overweight or obese is dieting.
So
almost every person who's overweight has been on at least one diet, and usually more. So dieting isn't the solution. Dieting is the cause.
Right. So starving yourself, you're setting yourself up for food preoccupation in the future.
I really believe that that is, we're seeing it most now with the children getting heavy so fast, because we don't know any other solution except for put kids on a diet. But very quickly, we're seeing that is a huge risk factor for the kids just becoming really overweight really, really quickly.
Well, because they're probably going to rebel when they get older.
Well, they don't have that discipline. So they get food preoccupied and they eat everything in sight. They as soon as they're out of your sight, they go
to a friend's house.
They go and get the candy and the soda and then they just gorge on it. Because they don't think about the future. They are not thinking about what they look like or their weight. And we're looking at them going, oh my God, you're going to suffer. It's going to be so terrible. But they don't have that. So we can see what really happens as a result of dieting. Then we need to look at what's actually in the food, the hedonic quality of it,
right.
the drugs in our food, but particularly the sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So people say it's like, well, you know, people ate sugar and things like, yeah, sugar has a very long history. We could do a whole podcast on this because it is really, you know, people think of like slavery is cotton.
Yes.
But it really was all this sugar and the rum trade and things like that. It's like once people got sugar, we wanted it and we wanted a lot of it and we were willing to do a lot to get it.
Well, sugar, people forget, was super dangerous to get in the first place.
Right, and
hard work. Yes.
You know, it's a stick.
Right.
You know, a hard stick that has to go through a lot. And, you know, you're not going to eat too many of those sticks. You're not going to have access.
Yeah.
It was the refining and making so much sugar so available.
Mm-hmm.
And we never get tired of it. You don't have to teach a human being to like sweet. Babies like sweet from the first day that they're born. They have a sweet face. You touch a tip of sugar water on their tip of their tongue and they make a happy face. And that you touch something bitter or sour and they spit it and they make a grimace face.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually like more sweet even better. So they can tell the difference on the first day of their life. And that's why human breast milk is actually sweeter than other animals, because our human babies are really helpless and they're not very strong and they can't eat very much.
Mm-hmm.
So we addict them to sugar in our own milk that Mother Nature gave us so that our babies would eat enough to grow
right.
their brain and growth. So we're set up for this. So you don't ever have to teach someone. You do not have to teach someone to like sugar.
So it's built into us to, I suppose, be a little bit food preoccupied as we grow. So we eat enough to grow.
Right. We are food preoccupied because of that big brain. Okay. We have to be food preoccupied. And then we have these medicines, or that pharmacy that is in our brain, and that when they find that they can alter foods over time, chemically or mechanically or the way that they grow them, that they become more hedonic or more pleasurable or more hitting our drug receptors that are there. Because if it works, it's because there's a receptor for us somewhere in our brain. So we know now that, like, wheat has these narcotic properties. So they make you feel like withdrawal if you eat a lot of it. So you feel like uncomfortable or painful and doesn't go away. It's not like pain, but it's like being dope sick a little bit. Like, you feel uncomfortable until you eat something that has the grain in it, and then that goes away. The sugar, it has this anticipatory value. It's the candy, it's the sodas. Mm-hmm. Like, you get, and then the more sugar you eat, you often have a yeast overgrowth, which is, everybody has this microbial life, the gut biome, they call it, that lives inside you, and it's all about the balance. Well, when you start getting more yeast, especially, they love the sugar, and I call them the yeasty beasties, and they're all going, eat a sugar, feed a sugar, feed a sugar, and they control you.
Right.
Like one of those science fiction movies where there's like the guy inside their head, like running the show up there, and it's like, it looks like a big human, but it's actually a robot with a, like, you know, diabolical Mr. Meanie or something up running the show. And that's those yeasty beasties going, sugar, 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 find sugar, feed sugar, eat sugar, 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 sugar. Mm-hmm. The more sugar you feed them, the more they grow and replicate, and the more sugar that they want. Right. So we can't stop a lot of times. So we need to control our environment, put real food in it, understand that the processed food is just very, very difficult to resist. So if you find that when you avoid foods that you're resisting them, like, then you need to get them away from you.
Right.
You need to avoid temptation, not resist temptation. You need to make sure that your body is adequately nourished. You know, we will talk more about sleep and lights and things like that, and we're seeing more and more of that connection. But, you know, if you're telling your body it's endless summer, where it would be great to be American and work and be very productive and make a lot of money and buy more stuff, then, you know, it's in our genes to like more lights, more sugar, and live in that 7-Eleven and eat, 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 work, 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 make more money so you can buy a nice vacation.
Right.
Right. Like, it's like, so you can enjoy yourself. It's like, oh, no, I don't really enjoy myself, but, you know, I need to enjoy myself because I'm feeling this, you know, hamster on the wheel, except for even hamsters on the wheel don't do that.
Yes.
Just Americans do that. So, you know, we don't really relax, but we do have our brain that enables us to control the environment we live in. That's how we got into this problem. Mm-hmm. We started to adapt the world to us.
Right.
So when we started building zoos and we set animals off, you know, and we wanted to display them in a certain way, we made these beautiful cages for them. Mm-hmm. And they didn't thrive. And now we know in zoos what you need to do is put animals in a more natural habitat, and they don't have so many bad habits, and they don't get chronically ill, and they're more fertile, and they behave normally, and they don't get overweight. And the way to do that is that we need to understand that we're decorating our own zoo. We live in these boxes that are cages with entertainment and Prozac, and, you know, because we don't know what to do with ourselves, because we keep changing the world and our bodies just don't live well in the world we've designed.
So true. I think that as humans now, we just have to work a little bit harder in setting ourselves up for success and setting ourselves up for no food. Well, we're always going to have a bit of food preoccupations, but, you know, it's all about setting your environment up. So, you know, if you always give in to being able to get into the car and drive down to the grocery store and buying yourself whatever you want, it's those type of things that you need to eradicate.
Right. Those need to be fenced out.
Right.
They need to be away.
Right.
And it's harder for some people than it is for others. So you have to give yourself a break because it's in your physiology.
Mm-hmm.
But understanding what's cueing it is really important. And that basically you need to understand that you need to design your own zoo.
Mm-hmm.
Because a zoo is just a habitat designed by humans for animals, and humans are animals. Mm-hmm. So the zoo we have designed for ourselves is an unhealthy one for us. Even though we might be on display and, you know, it might be very beautiful, it doesn't necessarily make us happy and healthy. So the solution isn't to keep treating our unhappiness and our unhealthiness. It's to change the habitat, because habitats are what make habits.
Okay.
So surrounding yourself with the right routine, eating the correct diet for a human being, which means food, not food forgeries, which we talk about a lot, this is the way to start avoiding this food preoccupation of, I'm thinking about food literally every moment except for when I'm eating, and sometimes when I am eating. Yeah. I'm already thinking about what I'm going to eat next.
Right. So true. Well, listen, Dr. Teresa, thank you so much for giving us a detailed insight into the food preoccupation. I always feel like you hit it at angles that people don't really ever think about. So I would like to thank you for that. It definitely is food for thought. that was a big pun there. Thank you again for coming in to chat to us.
It just needs to be real food for thought.
Right, exactly.
The thought is your brain, yes. And your brain is making you do the wrong things, but you have to do the right things. You get your messages right.
Right, that's so true. Well, thank you everybody for listening to us having a chat today. Tune into our other podcasts. We talk loads about other different topics. Loads of other different topics in our ladies' rooms. And we pretty much cover everything, I guess, you know.
Absolutely. Well, and if you have any questions, just let us know, and we will be happy to address them in future ladies' rooms, too.
Absolutely. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Take care, and we'll see you soon.
Bye for now.